joy, 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 ever new joy, joy.
Sudarshan.
Hi, Dunbara.
You love to tell stories.
Well, I sat down one time and I tried to write down all the stories I've... Well, let's see. Was it all the stories you've written? No. This was a different thing. I was trying to write down the stories of all the places that we've been in Northern California because we were I was going to do a little presentation about quick getaways in Northern California for local people here, people at Ananda. And I started writing down all the different places we'd been that were memorable. And I got 5 pages worth of notes. And by the time I got done with the presentation, or by the time they kicked me out, actually, I was to page 3. And so we agreed that I'd come back. So anyway, I had a story for every one of them. So.
Well, how about let's start with your upbringing.
Okay. Kind of a biography. I was born in Southern California, in Fullerton, California, in 1948. And I grew up in a standard Southern California suburban home. But both my parents were country people. Mom grew up in a dairy in Eastern California, in Lone Pine. Dad was from Colorado and Nevada. And so we were out every weekend, nearly, going to different natural spots. So I got a lot of natural environmental education, I guess you could say, and developed quite a love for being out in nature with that. And I grew up, went to high school. This was kind of fun. I was a camp counselor for YMCA when I was young. I think I was 13 when I started doing day camp, and the kids were only like 2 or 3 years younger than I was. But they apparently liked me, you know, and I seemed to have been successful with it. Went through Boy Scouts and Explorer Scouts and that sort of thing. Went to UC San Diego in the second year that it was accepting undergraduates. So that was interesting. That was a marvelous experience. There were Nobel laureates walking across the quad. You could stop and talk to somebody. Linus Pauling, Harold Urey, you know, whoever you wanted to, if they wanted to talk to you. And so it was quite an amazing experience. Angela Davis was there, if you know who she is, activist. So, and I got involved in that kind of thing. So I went to Berkeley and I didn't experience People's Park, but I experienced some, you know, other protest movements during right about that time. Right about that time, I started getting interested in meditation. And I took TM initiation, actually, when I was there. The way I found this out, I had a friend. She wasn't a girlfriend because she had a boyfriend, but she was a friend. And she talked about how her boyfriend had taken TM meditation and it done him a lot of good. And I thought, well, if Linda says it does you good, I'll try it myself. And so I tried it out. And I also did something which I thought was kind of fun. I'm glad I did, I guess is the thing to say, is I said, I'm not going to worry about it. I'm just going to do what they say to do for a year. And at the end of a year, I'm going to look at it and see how I feel. And sure enough, at the end of the year, I felt better. So that was, I realized, I think this is a good thing. So experience taught me. So there was a hitch. That was actually when I took a year off. I took a sabbatical from college and went up to Berkeley just to see what was going on there. And then when I came back to UCSD, then I lived in a community environment. I loved the idea of communes and communities. It was just great. And they were happening all the time everywhere there in those days. And I lived in 2 or 3, which were mainly basically students getting together and renting a mansion or a big house. We had a fantastic big house on a hill in Del Mar, California, at one point. And one fellow who used to do yoga postures all the time, and he meditated. And I thought, wow. And he, with his big, you know, salesman's eyes, said, you should read this book. And he handed me Autobiography of a Yogi. And And I liked Wadey, and I appreciated him, but I just couldn't get into the book. And I was so embarrassed because I didn't even want to talk to him because knowing him, he'd ask me, "Well, how did you like it?" I slipped it under his, I put it by his door one night and ran away, But it was a very interesting thing that, and the SRF Encinitas Hermitage was right nearby. But I never tuned into it when I was there. I thought it was part of, they say that California is the land of fruits and nuts. And so I sort of thought, well, yeah, it probably is. And so I thought that was just another one of those weird, offbeat organizations. And they were all over the place, too. There were very odd leftover things like, where was it, in Point Loma, the Theosophist Colony. You could still go there and look. And it was a college by then, but you could feel the vibrations there. It was really quite interesting. It was very good. But anyway, a year later, I was living in Fullerton, where I grew up, and I was seized with a desire to read that book. And I went down to the public library, and I said to the librarian, I said, I'm embarrassed. I don't even know the name of this book. But it's got a picture of this guy on the cover, and he's got long hair, and he's smiling. And she said, stop right there. She said, I know that book. And she led me right to the shelf, pulled it off, Autobiography of the Yogi, and I said, this is it! So I read it in two nights, 2 days. And it was time for me to read it. And so I sent off for the lessons, and... Yeah, I better not tell all these stories because we'll run out of time. But suffice it to say, not too long after that, I had known about Ananda because I worked in the Solana Beach Natural Foods Co-op, which I was a member of, and they had Ananda candies by the cash register. Bhagavan bars and David Delights and Moksha mints. And they were, just little squares of something, chewy stuff, wrapped up in foil and with very fanciful, hippie printed, labels. And apparently I found out later that there was one lady, and I don't remember her name, who was a real hotshot salesperson, traveled all over Northern California promoting Ananda candies, and Ananda candies were everywhere. And so I asked about Ananda there at the cash register, and the person who was there said, oh yeah, that's a community. That was great as far as I was concerned. And they study Yogananda's teachings. Well, I'd read the Autobiography of a Yogi. Okay, I thought, bingo. And so I thought, next time I get up to Northern California, I'm going to go visit. Well, I did. A girlfriend and I got in my 1954 Willys Jeep station wagon. And we took a road trip along Highway 49 in California. And by the time we got to Sacramento, we ran out of money. And so I called up Ananda from there. I found the phone number. There was only one phone at Ananda at that point. It rang in Pubble. And I got Keshava. And I always remember, I said, well, my girlfriend and I are thinking of walking to Ananda from Sacramento. We never did that, but it was kind of a pipe dream that we had. And Keshava didn't quite know what to think about that, I can imagine now. But he was being very positive. And he said, oh, that would be just lovely. Anyway, he was very welcoming. And so we came up and visited. And so that was fine. The story that I had was that I came up to Ananda more and more often after that, and I finally decided I was going to save gas money by just moving here. And so that was a process of about 2 years. I had a good job working in a steel products factory. I ran a giant drill press, and I learned welding there, and I ran a giant beam punch, which had I-beams that were like 40 feet long. They were made out of steel that thick. And this enormous machine with a big flywheel on it, which was built during World War II sometime, had little punches, and it would punch holes. And you had to get the holes just in the right place. So anyway, that was what I did. And I made good money doing that for those days. And of course, when I was living in Sacramento, I had my own little house. Some younger people who are watching this might be interested in this. It was a small house. I rented from a landlady there in northern Sacramento. I paid $50 a month rent for that. And did quite well, and I was able to save a lot of money living there. So I came up to Ananda, and I kept putting it off because I knew that as soon as I got to Ananda, there would be no more money coming in. I mean, I might get a job, but I already knew because I had joined the Ananda Sacramento Meditation Group. And there were Ganesha and Saraswati and Sahadev. Mm-hmm. And Durgadas and Jayanti, okay? And Durgadas has since passed away, and Jayanti is remarried, and she's still involved with the Ananda Sacramento Center. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I had gotten to know Ananda a lot by the time I moved here. And I kept putting off moving here because I thought, well, let me just put one more paycheck in the bank before I get up here. So I was going to move in the fall of 75, but I finally got here in February of 76. I just didn't feel I could put it off any longer. And so I was here in time for the fire, the big Ananda fire. And I had brought a trailer up here, but even in those days, they said that you can't live in a trailer here because of county regulations, even in February of 76. But it made a good story, should. And besides that, I tried to start a business, and I was going to make wood stoves. A local surplus company had World War II surplus U.S. Navy depth charge casings with no TNT in them. They were empty. And they made great wood stoves. And so during the, for a period in Ananda, Kent White converted a lot of these things. His name is Bhima now. And because he had a metal products company and he had the welders and so forth to do this. So, he made a success out of it. I made one that was too good, took too much time. So I made a prototype. But I started realizing that I was just not getting to know anybody. I was not mixing with people at Ananda because I was in the shop all day long. And so when I kept on getting job offers. And finally, when the third job offer came of going to the meditation retreat and being a maintenance person there, I finally thought, I think Divine Mother's trying to tell me something. And so I said yes to that, and I kept the one wood stove. It was great. I used it for years up until about 2 or 3 years ago. It was here, right where this wood stove is here. Best wood stove we ever had. And we mourned it when it left. But very soon I worked at Ananda Press. I was in charge of Ananda Press. People didn't worry too much in those days about whether you actually knew how to print, if you were in charge of an Ananda printing press. But I tried to learn, and fortunately we had a man named Jack. I might remember his last name at some point, but who was a career printer, and he was able to show us the ropes, show us what to do. And the first edition of The Path came out printed at Ananda Press. And I haven't seen one of those recently, but it's thicker than the other older editions of The Path and be an interesting collector's item. So I did that for a while, and oh gosh, there's been so many things. Savitri and I moved to Palo Alto, and we were ministers there. We went to San Diego. We did that. We were at Ocean Song before Palo Alto was Ocean Song. And I think Sabaji mentioned that in her interview. Ocean Song was amazing. There are any number of stories from people who are who have spent their lives at Ananda and are very, very influential at Ananda, who spent some time at Ocean Song in their formative years. We had a going community. We had a school that was extremely popular in the area. Most of our students were not Ananda people. It was just like the Ananda school here. The parents liked what they saw, and they wanted to put their kids in it. So, and we taught meditation classes. Savitri taught meditation classes. I organized them all over the rural little Sonoma County towns like Monte Rio and Forestville, I think, or I'm not sure, Healdsburg, Santa Rosa, Sebastopol, all over the place there. And they were very well received. People loved them. So regular church services, it was like a miniature Ananda, just, you know, a wonderful, wonderful time. Mm-hmm. So anyway, more recently, we have lived here, and I have just gravitated towards construction work and worked on the Temple of Light, the Moksha Mandir, the Living Wisdom Center. Mm-hmm. And I found out, oh, this is a little funny story. I have always been a generalist, but I know my way around materials, okay? So I've never really specialized in anything. One day, Nikula, who was in charge of building something at one time, and I was working there, he saw me gluing together some PVC pipe. And this isn't very difficult. You put glue on it and stick it together, okay? And he saw that, and his eyes got wide, and he said, "You're a plumber." And I said, "I'm not a plumber. I mean, I'm gluing together." But he said, "You're a plumber." You know, and the next thing you know, in typical Nikula fashion, I was in charge of plumbing some project or other. So it was definitely learning by doing. And so since that time, I've learned more and more and more by doing. Mm-hmm. So there's no end of desire, need and desire for me to be doing work like that. And also, I tend to characterize myself as a construction problem solver, because oftentimes there's something that nobody knows what to do with. Oh, the Living Wisdom Center. I mean, no, excuse me, the temple. The Temple of Light project was an interesting example of that. We had a situation where we needed to put in very large gauge pipe, like 4-inch and 6-inch pipe. And it was not the kind of stuff where you glue it together. It had special cast iron hunkuses with bolts in them to put it together. And we needed to put in a fire hydrant, and we needed to put in a fire department connection, which if you don't know what that is, you don't know what it is. And of course, we didn't know what it was. And we had the local San Juan Fire Department was very was tasked with making sure that they were inspecting us and making sure that we do this right. And we had the California Fire Marshal, at least the Fire Marshal's office representative for here, over here, and telling us about this. But finally, I kept on asking people, okay, now how do you put this stuff together, and what, you know, which thing comes first, and that sort of thing. We had a very sketchy diagram of what we were supposed to put together, but no details whatsoever. And I asked, every person I asked, I said, well, how do you do this? And I always got sort of evasive answers, and I realized nobody knew. Nobody knew how to put it together. And yet I was tasked with doing this, you know. And so finally, and also the supplier, we had a specialized supplier that supplied this specialized equipment. And of course, the salespeople there knew how to sell the stuff. And they knew sort of vaguely what it was. And they had a few hints. I mean, they sort of knew what you did. So by interviewing and pumping everybody I possibly could, I managed to put together some kind of a sketchy idea of what we were supposed to do with this stuff. And finally, we managed to put it together. And it did blow up once, but we managed to repair that. And finally, we got it all put together, and it all passed. You know, by the way, the inspectors all just looked at it and went, check. Because they didn't know what they were looking at. They did, sort of. But, you know, they got their part done, you know. But as far as actually putting it in, it was another thing. So anyway, I said, problem solver. If I'd have known that I was facing that in the beginning, I never would have taken it on. But somehow I'm still alive now. So anyway, that's been kind of a story that kind of characterizes what my life has been like lately. Because Ananda is doing larger things than perhaps Nevada County is used to doing. Mm. And so nobody really knows, you know, in some cases. So you just got to do the best you can to figure it out. So suffice it to say, life is not boring. And but anyway, I have found also lately, I'm very much of a people person on a one-on-one basis. And also I do group things too. And I do teach classes and so forth. But I just hang out with individuals. So, and we talk about, I started out in Palo Alto doing this. We used to do I was the Kriya minister there. This was back in the 90s. I was the Kriya minister there, and I was supposed to do Kriya checks, and I sort of tried to get it organized so that, you know, I even tracked people down to see how they were doing. And people were grateful for it. And it turned out that I wasn't really doing Kriya conferences. I was doing sadhana conferences. Because we were talking about, well, how's your spiritual life going? You know, and how do your thought patterns relate to your meditation? How does your meditation relate to your life? You know, and all this stuff. And I learned not to be penetrating about it, but people generally wanted to talk about it. And so I guess that's continued over time. To where I have a lot of personal interaction with a lot of people around the community, and not nearly as much as Savitri does, who spends an awful lot of time doing that kind of thing. And also, one of the major things that has been so important in my life is that I picked up on the idea of seclusion. I remember that one time, Vijay Girard, many years ago, this may have been even before I moved to Ananda, but because Swami had gone to India, perhaps in 1972, I think, or maybe it was a later trip, when he stayed in Kashmir on the houseboat. So somebody may be able to correct me on that. It may have been 74. But Vijay, in his very enthusiastic manner, was saying, Swami's meditating like 12 hours a day, and he's doing 1,000 kriyas. And I thought, wow, you know, this wasn't public, probably isn't public knowledge now either, but it wasn't then. And I thought, wow, that sounds great. You know, the guy's really diving in. And I thought, so I think that impressed me. And I thought, well, let me try taking seclusion. And Swami always emphasized seclusion. He says, do it. And, of course, he took seclusions all, you know, I mean, regularly, not all the time, but at least yearly. He took, and he would take a month at a time, too. I mean, or at least several weeks at a time. And so I thought, well, let me do it. So I started practicing the best I could tell what to do in seclusion, but there was no outline. I asked several older members, Shivani and Jaya, probably Jaya Helene and others, and I got a few pointers and tips. But there was no real outline for what you did. And Swami, to my knowledge, never really wrote anything down about how to take a seclusion, you know, what to do. And but he really encouraged you to do it. And I thought, well, there's a little vacuum here. So eventually, finally, I wound up writing a little booklet about seclusion. And to this day, I wrote it in the, I think I first printed it in the 90s. And to this day, people buy it and use it. So so it's, gosh, I think it's sold a few thousand copies by now over all these years. And it desperately needs revision now, but still the old one suffices. So, and is helpful to people. So, so anyway, getting back to seclusion. So I wound up taking, well, I started out taking a week of seclusion, and then I graduated to 2 weeks. And then finally because I was working in construction work, and construction work usually slows down in the wintertime. In the wintertime, I figured I could take a month. And so I've been in that habit for many, many years now. And so, oh, it's just absolutely marvelous. You get to just spend some time with God, spend quality time with God. I call seclusion adventures in consciousness. And it's become that more and more and more lately, that it really is. It's adventures in consciousness. It's holding hands with God, Divine Mother, holding hands with God, and listening and, you know, talking and even kind of joking around in some ways. Divine Mother has a tremendous sense of humor. And so anyway, I can see a progression and an evolution through the different seclusions about what's been happening and how I feel just so fantastically uplifted and very many, many lessons in meditation, and how to proceed with meditation, what consciousness to hold in meditation, how to go into different areas of consciousness. It really is inner adventures. And there's, you're dealing with infinity. One thought that I came up with recently is, in order to meditate effectively, you really need to have a healthy relationship with eternity. And because it can be overwhelming. And in fact, it can be very scary. It is fantastically scary. In fact, Swami used to mention that. He said that you come face to face with this and it's frightening. Just because it's so overwhelming. He said the power is so great that it could snuff you out and not even know it had done it. Mm-hmm. And those were his words. And it's not that I feel, you know, physical danger, like my seclusion cabin is going to evaporate in smoke. But although it could, it's more this kind of feeling of your existence. Who am I? What am I? Okay, what is God? Well, seclusion gives you answers. Okay, and they're heart answers. They're intuitional answers. They come through feeling. They don't so much come through thought. Mm-hmm. And part of meditation or seclusion meditation, where you can really dive in and go into it, is a process of getting to know who you really are and who God really is, and relaxing with that, and in many ways losing who you are, losing who you think you are. The ego, in quotes, is not bad, but it's a very limited tool. And many, many people, I think 99% of the population of the earth, thinks that the ego and the body is me. Well, but we know from the teachings that me is way bigger than that. Me extends to infinity. Me extends to eternity. The soul is an integral part of God. Well, getting comfortable with that and living with it and working with it, you know, is part of the trick. So I'm talking very, very generally. And I got 1,000 stories to tell about that, but at least that's the overview. So that's been thrilling for me. And And so then that sort of remembrance of consciousness is what informs, you know, my whole life. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, you're asking about origins up to the present moment. I think I've sort of covered it. There's a lot of other stories mm-hmm. and a lot of other things that have happened, but that's kind of an outline.
Great. So I have two questions.
Okay.
One is hearkening back to when you ran out of money in Sacramento.
Uh-huh.
How did you get to Ananda Village?
We got in the Jeep, the 1954 Jeep, and utility wagon, and we drove up here.
I thought you ran out of gas.
Oh, no, we didn't run out of gas. We ran out of money.
Oh, money.
We
okay.
ran out of money.
All right.
And there are many stories about people running out of gas coming
yes.
here, too, and miraculous things, but that didn't happen to me.
Okay.
So, no, we drove up, and we took a program.
Because when you told Keshava that you were going to walk from Sacramento.
Right. Here, yeah, I didn't give that much energy. The thought was that we would do an athletic, adventure. And we're going to put backpacks on. And Gori was the name of the lady. Or she took that name later.
Uh-huh.
Christine was the girlfriend. And she actually came up here. We broke up. We split up. And she came here. She married somebody else and had some children. And but they all moved away, you know, after some time.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, we were thinking of doing that. I'm sorry I didn't keep that detail straight, but we never did it.
Okay.
And so we wound up driving up instead.
All right. You
that
did
have been
you did
much
have wheels, though, so, yeah.
Adventure, which we didn't do.
Okay.
We could have, though. So.
And the other question is, how can people get a hold of the seclusion guide that you wrote?
Oh, yeah. Unfortunately, it's only available currently from me in a printed form. And so if somebody wants to send me $7 on PayPal is a real good way to do it. And give me an address, I'll mail it to them.
Okay.
Oh, actually, $7 plus postage and handling, so I think it's $10 total. But
all right.
Yeah. In case anybody listens to this and wants to do it.
Okay. So. And that's no electronic version.
No electronic version currently. Yeah. If I could just put the energy out to get it on Amazon, mm-hmm. On Kindle.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then it would be better.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Great. Well, you're a really good, experienced storyteller, filler-inner of, the timeline, so that's great.
Yeah.
What kind of things are you enthusiastic about?
Inner communion is really the answer, mm-hmm. and that's what I'm enthusiastic about. But I spoke about that talking about seclusion. Let's see. I like knickknacks and gadgets. You know, I'm a gadget guy, and so I occasionally pick up odd and curious tools. And it's interesting that when I do that, very often, all of a sudden, I have a need for it, and it works. And sometimes this is even something from the 19th century. And it will do the job. So that's kind of a hobby that gets my manual dexterity, operating. I tend to get drawn into things like just recently my mom died at 99 3/4.
Wow.
And I was the trustee of the estate. So I wind up taking care of things like that. So mm-hmm. right now I'm learning how to be a trustee and administer a trust, which is a whole new thing.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing was when Savitri had heart surgery mm-hmm. not too long ago, maybe 6 years ago, something like that, maybe less. I wound up dealing with the insurance companies and the medical billing and that sort of thing. I learned a lot about the process.
Mm-hmm.
There's our financial system as it goes around as it revolves around medical care, is kind of broken in this country, mm-hmm. and or perhaps in the world. And you need to mind your P's and Q's. You need to watch, mm-hmm. and don't take no for an answer, and be patient and calm and forthright. And you wind up, I mean, a lot of times, some of the bills that you receive are phishing bills. Hmm. I mean, from the hospital, I mean, from an official place. Hmm. And they're trying to see if they can get more money from you, above and beyond what the insurance company paid. And if you just keep on asking questions and keep on working with it, eventually they say, oh, that bill was canceled. Canceled? Why? Well, you know, it was phishing. So I don't blame them. They need to keep their doors open. And they figure out ways to do it. So anyway, I wind up getting deeper than most people do into different administrative kind of tunnels and warrens, mm-hmm. and, you know, and so forth. So I did have a story I thought I could tell about Swami, which I think I can relate to your question, because it does relate to something that I'm quite thrilled about. Okay. And if you like, I could tell you this. Mm-hmm. This is a very interesting experience that happened to me many years ago, and I was trying to place what year it was, but I know it was before Swami's dome at the Crystal Hermitage was covered over. It was still a white dome, okay? And what had happened was, some of the background for this, was that the dome had been added onto from so many different directions, been cut into so much, mm-hmm. that its structural integrity as a dome was compromised. And they were afraid that it might collapse. Mm. And I know you've had some experience with this up at the meditation retreat dome. And but in the case that you had, it was rotting beams in the dome. And it could have been true with Swami's too. But they just didn't quite know what to do. So I just happened to be walking down the steps from up where the Shrine of the Masters is now. And it may be the Shrine of the Masters wasn't there then either, because this was quite a while ago. And I came upon a group of builders. I think it was Michael Gornick and Panduranga and Nakula and, you know, all the people. It could have even been Arjuna was there. I'm not sure. There was maybe eight people there. And Swami. And they were all in a circle, and they were standing on the landing above where the waterfall is now. Mm-hmm. And they're looking down at the dome, or actually they'd been looking at the dome. And they were discussing what to do about it. And in those days, more than now, if you came upon something like that, people just invited, you know, just they were happy to have you join in. You know, I wasn't, in that case, I wasn't disturbing the meeting. And people were throwing around different ideas of what to do. And I remember listening, and there were quite a few different ideas, you know, creative ideas about what to do about the dome. And Swami was just listening to this. And at one point, I looked at it, and, you know, I decided to offer my opinion. And, of course, my opinion was not terribly welcome in that group, because I wasn't a professional builder, and what could I say? And but, you know, I felt like I could maybe offer something, and I was just sort of ruminating, and, you know. And I said, well, why don't you hang it from a cable, like a Christmas tree ornament, okay? It was very interesting. Swami's face swiveled right over to me, looked right at me, and he smiled. Okay, well, you need to know that later on, perhaps even a year after this meeting, what they did was they built what became known as the witch's hat. It was a whole structure with a roof on it that went over the dome, covered the dome, and guess what? The dome was connected by cables to support it, to lift it up so that it could hang, basically, kind of like a Christmas tree ornament, underneath the underneath that structure, underneath the witch's hat. So that's basically what they did. They wound up doing. At the time, people thought, yeah, okay. But Swami looked right at me, and it was like he had this devilish little smile. And I thought, now, wait a minute. You know, in retrospect, I look back on that. And I say, I think, that guy knew what was going to happen. I think. He knew what was going to happen. And he was looking at me and saying, you tuned in? Okay. But he wasn't saying, okay, boys, now listen, I've got an idea. We should do it this way. He wasn't doing that at all. He was allowing it to come, you know, come from them, which is what he always did. Mm-hmm. Okay. And now I don't know whether he was like had an architect's mind and he had already decided that that was what needed to happen. I don't think so. I think that he psychically or spiritually recognized what was going to happen, you know, kind of through a intuitional understanding. And he recognized that it had popped out of somebody's mouth. Okay. And it made me realize how he worked. You know, it made me, it's not so much realize, but in recent years, I've begun to see how intuition works. There's a feeling in the heart. The heart is the receiving station. Master said this is the transmitting station, and the heart is the receiving station. And Divine Mother is a master architect in this case. She's a master everything. She's a master doctor. She's a master builder. She's a master cook. She's a master everything. And she knows, but Swami was right in tune with the divine way. Is the divine way is, hey, this world, this physical world that we live in, is not set up to build something or to make something or to accomplish something. As Swami once said, I think Swami said this, we're not building a community, we're building souls, okay? I may not have that quote quite right, but the sense of it is that we're developing human potential. And this is permanent. I mean, when the person dies, in quotes, and moves on, they will bring the blessings, they will bring the transformed consciousness, the consciousness that was transformed in this lifetime, and they will bring that forward forever. Okay. And that's what we're doing. You know, we're not building a place that, you know, I don't know, climate change could completely wipe it off the face of the earth, and it wouldn't make that much difference. Okay. Mm-hmm. Compared to at least what had happened for the individual souls that were involved mm-hmm. here. Okay. And so that's how Divine Mother works. She cares about each individual thunderously, tremendously, completely, okay? Each individual, she loves each individual eternally and completely. And she's watching and helping that person to come up with the idea from the inside out, okay? And so that's what Swami was doing. That's what he was doing with all of us. All the time. And he was tuning into that. And you could see his human consciousness chafing at that. And remember, he used to say, 90% of the ideas that I have, I haven't been able to do. And his words were, people weren't ready for it. Huh. Well, in a way, you can see that as kind of a criticism. I mean, what was the matter with me that I couldn't tune into what he wanted to do? But I don't think that's exactly what he was saying. Is Divine Mother wanted to have it happen. I, Swami, got the idea because Divine Mother wanted it to happen, and I tried to tune into her. But it just couldn't happen because people couldn't get it from the inside out and have it be born within them. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, at Ananda, Swami was able to inspire people mm-hmm. in such a way that a lot of stuff did come from the inside out and did happen, mm-hmm. a tremendous amount. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I thought about that story and I thought, you know, that helped me to understand what he's really doing. Mm-hmm. And it didn't exactly help me at the time. At the time I thought, well, I don't know, you know, I don't know what's going on. But now looking back on it from what you know, from where I guess my consciousness is at this point, I see what a phenomenal story it is. It has its roots in eternity, you know, in how he was working with people and what he was doing. And what an absolutely marvelous person. I mean, it's staggering, you know, who he was and what he was. And I should say who he is. Because I'm sure he's quite busy right now. And he's maybe right here.
Yeah. So, when you say chafing, that he was probably chafing at that, do you mean just because he could sense that something was trying to happen, but on Divine Mother's behalf, but somehow it wasn't, that that's what he was chafing?
Well, I don't know. I may be projecting. I think I probably am projecting because I watch myself do that. In other words, I look at something and I think, you know, one of my concerns is with the whole world, not just Ananda, is that people don't tend to take care of things. You know, we build something and we allow it to deteriorate, whereas when, you know, if we just put a few drops of oil on it, or, you know, if we replaced a part before the entire thing blew up, you know, we would, we could be much more economical, you know, in our material life. And so I chafe, I gripe about that, okay? But I have to remind myself that that this is all a school. And the real important thing is the people, not the people, the egos, or as people who think they're separate from God, but their souls emerging and becoming more real, or becoming more conscious of that. So I may have been projecting on Swami, but that's what I felt I saw in him, was that his human side, and he definitely had a human side, to my knowledge, his human side would say, well, dang, you know, we tried this and it couldn't happen. Or I put my best effort into inspiring people to do this. Again, he worked with inspiration. It was the person who wanted to do it because they were enthusiastic about it. I think he probably did sometimes say, look, you've got to do this to somebody. But very rarely, I think that he inspired people, and or allowed God to inspire people through him, and so. But you know, I guess maybe I should talk about this a little bit. Is that again? I think I may not have this right, but I think I'm beginning to identify that we've lived with an ego. Either we've rebuilt it every time we incarnate, or we just keep the same one, you know, or maybe we modify it as we go along. Probably that's the right way. But the ego is something that thinks that I am separate from I, this little thing, which is maybe about this big and that wide, am separate and unique. And I'm separated from this enormous universe that goes on forever. Okay. And and that universe includes God's consciousness. In fact, it is God's consciousness. You know, the whole thing is God's consciousness, okay? And so we build walls. We build, you know, walls on our box, okay? And we reach outside of the box, but the box is our reality, okay? And so I'm beginning to see how, you know, if you meditate a lot, you start to move into a world which doesn't deal with the box. I mean, the box becomes irrelevant, sort of. And so you're just sort of sitting on the edge of a galaxy or something like that. I mean, I'm not talking from personal experience here, but I'm talking figuratively. But your consciousness is much bigger, such that, like in my most recent seclusion, I felt like I was communing with nature spirits. Okay, well, I've done it before. In fact, I've had very realistic, or very real, as best I can tell, connections with nature spirits around, because I go out in nature when I take seclusion, around a very real problem, which is mice in the trailer. And, I've had just this incredibly long and complex you know, going on for 20 years, interaction that way. But it's always been more or less Sudarshan here, okay, relating to something out there, which is not part of him. And I've often thought of a lot of times when you pray, it's like tying a note around a rock and pitching it over a wall, and you're hoping somebody gets it over on the other side. Okay? Well, prayer really is Divine Mother's right here. She's right here. She's closer than close. Okay? And praying is really praying to praying to yourself, in a sense, but not to your ego. You're praying to herself, which is yourself. It's very wild to try to feel this, but you can feel it. If you try to think about it, your brain shorts out. You know, smoke starts curling out of your ears. But if you feel it, and you can feel it in meditation, and maybe I should tell this one story. One time in a seclusion a few years ago, I was really trying to practice the presence of God, really trying to be with Divine Mother. Okay, so I got up, I did my morning stuff, and then I got out and I went out to energize, and I thought, well, let's do energization together, okay? And so as I was doing my energization, I felt Divine Mother's arms in my arms, you know, and everything, and you know, it felt pretty good, you know. And I'd say, you know, do you like doing it this way? Would you like to, you know, tense more or something? And you know, she'd usually say, well, I don't care, you know, but whatever. And but I was thinking, I had the thought in my mind, well, I'm praying to Divine Mother at all times, okay? And so at one point I had this image, because I sometimes get an image of what Divine Mother looks like, and I got this image of her, and she was going like this. And I said, what are you doing? And she opened her eyes and looked at me, and she kind of winked. She said, I'm praying to Divine Mother. Wait a minute. Who is who here? Okay. It's like she was basically subtly saying to me, we're one and the same. Okay, well, we say we're all one, and I'm one with God, and you know, but who am I? Which I is one with God? Okay. But the little box is one with God, even inside of it, but you don't know it. I mean, it's canceled. You know, it's like the... you get back an email message saying, I'm sorry I couldn't get to that address. Okay? So you've got a cancellation system going, you know, if you're trying to communicate outside of the box. So with the nature spirits, to finish the story, it was like they were saying, Sudarshan, come on. We're one and the same. You don't need to talk to us as if we're over there. Okay? We're all together. Okay? In some funny way, which I don't understand totally, but we are. And Divine Mother was trying to say that too. Hey, bozo, you know, clunk, 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 you know. You know, you don't need to live in there. You're hiding. Don't hide. Come on out and play. Okay, sort of. And so that's something I'm still working with. You know, I don't quite understand it totally. But I think Swami knew it very well. And Swami was working with us where we were at. He was not judging one bit. I mean, maybe he did occasionally. But he was attempting the best he could not to do that. But he was with the program. He understood that God is everybody. He loved the people around him with Divine Mother's love. Didn't matter whether Swami loved him or not. Who's Swami anyway? Okay. Again, these are all me kind of trying to understand a deeper and newer reality with this. So anyway, there's a lot of other stories that could go along with that. But I mean, I think that in your interviews, you'll find with many people, they'll be saying things like that, you know, how they felt one with everything, or how they realized that they were one with everything, or they rose up above something and they looked at the, I mean, you know, whoever it was, Joe might say, I looked at Joe down there and I thought, ha, look at him. He thinks he's separate, you know, or something like that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it's something that Swami has talked about and Master's talked about, but it's thrilling to get kind of a firsthand experience of it, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of feel it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's, I guess you asked me what are you most thrilled about or what do you like the most. I think that's kind of it. And it interweaves with everything, mm-hmm. you know, everything that's going on everywhere, you know. Yeah. I was chopping wood one day because the body needs exercise. As exercise, I chop all the wood that we burn here. Mm. You know, I take it from a tree that fell down and chop it up into lengths and split it up into pieces and, you know, and I don't use a wood splitter. I do it by hand, you know, which nobody does, but it's good exercise. But there's another interesting thing that happens is that you begin to get to have a feel for each log. Another thing that I do, which nobody does, is I use the knotty pieces too. I don't just select the straight grain stuff and leave the branches and crotches for Prakash to pick up or something. I take the whole thing, okay? And so, interestingly, I don't recommend this to anybody for the purpose of chopping wood, because it takes longer to do that. But I began to see how it is that the wood likes to split. Where are its weak points? And it's almost like I'm communing with the wood. I'm talking with it, and it's talking to me. I sort of made friends with it, and it will it talks to me. Well, what, you know, I'm even pointed at my heart. It's like there's a connection between that oak round that grew 100 years ago, something like that, and this heart, not my heart, it's this heart, and they talk to each other. And no big deal, it just is what it is. But it's part of this kind of, you know, everyday dance, mm-hmm. of connection that happens. So that's fun. I noticed that, you mm-hmm. know. I don't recommend it for chopping wood. I mean, I'm an idiot for doing this, but I get plenty of exercise, and that's my mm-hmm. my reason. Great. And but there was this interesting correlation, you know, mm-hmm. interesting side benefit that came from that. Great. So, and they happen all the time, more and more and more, mm-hmm. more and more and more, kind of feedback from the universe, mm-hmm. Of how this stuff works.
Great. How did you get your name?
Oh, Sudarshan, yeah. Swami used to give spiritual names in batches. You may remember this. And so this was before I moved to Ananda, but I was at a Christmas celebration probably 74, maybe 75. No, I think it was 74. And I had filed my application for a spiritual name, basically, with Swami's secretary, I think. I might have mentioned it to him at one point, but anyway, he used to give out batches at holidays, okay? So Christmas time came, and so several people got spiritual names. It was my understanding, and I need to check this out with Asha or somebody else who might know, or Shivani or somebody, but it's my understanding that Swami would, when he meditated on you, thinking about a spiritual name or looking for a spiritual name, trying to tune in to a spiritual name, he tried to see, or he sometimes found a quality which you had, which you already had, but which it would be good for you to develop. Now, I don't know whether that was a general thing or that he did sometimes, but it seems like he definitely did that with me. So he, you know, told several people their names, and he did it with me too. This was in the old common dome up at the meditation retreat. And he said, Sudarshan means seeing beauty. Su means beauty. And darshan means sight, actually. I looked this up. We think of darshan, you go to have darshan of a saint, you think it's a blessing of being with the saint. But in actuality, apparently, in Sanskrit, it's like when we say go to see somebody. Mm-hmm. You are seeing them, you know, but actually you're visiting with them. Mm-hmm. And so darshan means having the sight of the saint, okay? So he said that sudarshan means seeing beauty. And I thought about that a little bit later, especially in reference to this understanding that I thought I had. And I realized, yes, I always have. I remember, I can imagine that I was driving along in a car with a group of people, and I look out and I see a cloud bank, and I say, wow, aren't those clouds beautiful? And other people would look out and say, well, they're clouds. You know, it's like somehow I saw beauty in it, whereas most people would just say, okay. And so I realized that I did have that. And then later on, I started thinking, another thing I do is I see beauty in people. And it's not so much that they have high cheekbones or they're outwardly pretty, you know, to look at or handsome, but it's their inner beauty. And I thought, whoa, you know I do that, because I'll meet somebody and I'll maybe look in their eyes. The eyes are the window of the soul. Or I'll just have a feeling about them, and I'll feel a beauty that's welling up from within them. Mm-hmm. And then I tune into it, and I try to experience it a little bit more, or, you know, kind of open it up a little bit. And usually that's okay. Sometimes they don't like that, but because that's kind of their precious possession. But but anyway, usually people appreciate that. And so now Swami also said, and he got a good laugh with this at that ceremony. He said it can also mean sight of beauty. You know, in other words, you're a handsome guy, okay? And but he said, but I would prefer you to think about it in the previous way. But actually, I did look up a story of a guy named Sudarshana from the Ramayana, I believe. And it was a good story. It he was very proud. He was handsome, and he's very proud of his being handsome. Okay, and he was flying along in his Vimana one time, perhaps with some friends. You know, the flying carpet thing, and you know, they did that in those days. And he looked down and he saw a group of deformed saints, okay, people who had club feet or whatever, walking along. And he looked down and he said, ha, 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 look at them. Aren't they so ugly? Ha, ha, ha. You know, as if, aren't I lucky that I'm so handsome, you know. And well, you don't do that to saints. So, pizzap, they put a doom on him. And what do they call it? Well, it's the opposite of a boon, but I'm not sure quite what. The doom is an Irish expression. But anyway, and he immediately turned into a snake, a boa constrictor or something like that. And which, you know, I tend to think that that snakes are good looking, but, you know, but apparently that's an ugly thing, you know. And so, fast forward, I think 500 years or so, and Lord Rama is walking through the forest with his retinue, and there's a big consternation, and somebody's screaming, and they're being attacked by this giant snake. And Lord Rama, knowing what's going on, reaches over and touches the snake with his foot, and poof, it turns back into Sudarshana. And Sudarshana immediately goes and kneels at Lord Rama's feet and say, thank you, thank you, thank you for releasing me from this curse. I will never, ever, you know, be proud again, you know, like I was. And of course, Lord Rama, being omnipresent, knew the whole story. And so anyway, that was kind of a fun story. So.
Can you pray us out and just send energy to whoever's watching?
Sure, yeah. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend of Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Guru, Paramhansa Yogananda, friend and guide, Swamiji. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for the marvelous teachings which you share with us. Bless us in our efforts. Come into our hearts and instruct us and show us what it is that we are looking at and that we're feeling. And help us to develop that way until in that process we hold your hand and become one with the infinite. Om Shanti. Amen.